We've got some big picture stuff, of course, this week in the economy. The dollar as well, strong or not strong. Also, Elvis. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday, the 26th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So much to talk about this week. So little time. So in we dig. Catherine Rampell is at the Washington Post. Kate Davidson is at the Wall Street Journal. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai. Kai.
So, Catherine, let me start with you. And I suppose reverse chronological is the way we're going to do this. The GDP report this morning, 2.1%. Nice, you know, solid-ish, but basically all consumers, right?
Yeah, consumers are running the show here, which is a little bit unfortunate, particularly since the mechanism by which these tax cuts that we got in late 2017 were supposed to supercharge the economy was through incentivizing greater business investment. And in fact, business investment fell in the second quarter of this year, which suggests either some combination of the tax cuts aren't doing what we were told they would do, and or if they are having an effect, it's being canceled out by whatever uncertainty businesses are feeling due to trade policy.
So to those businesses, Kate Davidson, what are they doing with their money? I mean, granted, there is trade policy uncertainty, but they had a while where taxes were in their favor, and yet here we are.
That's right, Kai. I mean, I think you've talked a lot about it. We've heard a lot about this idea of share buybacks. Right. That's really the main thing that we've seen. Last year, companies set a record for share buybacks. That dipped a little bit at the beginning of this year, but it's still very robust. There is some business investment. As Catherine pointed out, it fell in the second quarter, but there has been some. We saw a bunch of it last year, but I do think that it's becoming more and more clear as the months of these trade disputes go on, that companies are, they're holding off. They're waiting to see how these trade disputes are going to shake out. And I think that the longer it drags on, where we don't know what's going to happen with China, we don't know if the president's going to announce some new kinds of tariffs, as he did with Mexico earlier this year, that we hadn't anticipated. Companies are going to, I think, be holding back on new investments.
So here we are now, Catherine. The president has talked long and hard, as have all his advisors, about 3% economic growth, how we're definitely going to get it, and that'll take care of everything, and it's going to be fine. And now here we are, oh, by the way, at 2.1%, which is firmly in the Obama growth profile after a huge recession.
Yes. And look, the numbers can be noisy quarter to quarter, so it's not like we should put stock in one quarter's numbers, but the numbers from last year are now below 3%, which was, again, this target that was supposed to be this magic number that Trump was going to deliver not only 1 year, but in perpetuity, something along those lines. And we haven't seen that happen. And what's disturbing, of course, is that a lot of economists expected that the biggest bang for your buck that we would get from these tax cuts might be in the first year because there was this sudden rush of newly available capital, et cetera. And if even in that first year, we couldn't meet that magical number of 3%, which for some reason we have decided is the goal or the promise at the very least. What happens going forward? You know, the issue is that the United States economy faces these much longer term structural problems, particularly demographic problems, that, you know, just a simple sugar high of a fiscal stimulus, which is ultimately what we got through the tax cut and through spending increases, cannot solve.
All right. So, Kate, let's turn to the long term picture here. And I want to talk about something you wrote about this week, the debt and deficit. There was, of course, the budget deal. It's going to add more money to the deficit over the next couple of years. It does seem, first of all, that nobody in Washington, whether they are hawks or doves on the deficit, no matter what they say, they just don't vote in a way that would make you think they care about how much money we owe.
I think that's right, Kai. That's something that we've seen for a couple of years now. First, we had the giant tax cut, which, of course, is expected to add about $1 trillion to deficits over a decade. Then shortly after that, there was a very large budget deal last year, nearly $300 billion above spending levels that were set in these earlier spending caps that were negotiated. Remember the Tea Party wave and everyone was concerned about deficits, 2011. Basically, we've just reached these, Congress has reached these two-year agreements every couple of years since then to lift spending. Now, with this latest deal, fiscal hawks who are outside of Congress looking in are saying, what are you guys doing? Right. You're basically, $1 trillion deficits are now enshrined in the law. They become permanent. And oh, by the way, in a couple of years, those spending caps that everyone worked toward back in 2011, they're going to expire. So there's really nothing that's going to be no sort of automatic cuts that are holding things down. On the flip side, folks who are supporting these deals are saying discretionary spending on non-defense programs, things like health and education and infrastructure is at historical lows. And it's really, if you look at the numbers, it's basically level where it was in 2011. There haven't in reality right. been these actual increases. So and furthermore, they're pointing to the fact that yields, borrowing costs are still extremely low. So why should they worry about deficits right now? So it's an interesting argument that's happening. And they're getting some backup from economists, mainstream economists, too, who are coming around to this idea that we might not have to worry so much about deficits if the economy keeps growing. So I think you're right. There's very little incentive for politicians to vote that way. And also, voters don't seem to care that much either. So it's kind of this perfect storm for deficit hawks.
There's always that. Catherine, let me wrap it up with you in the last 30 seconds we have left. The reason the growth matters that the Trump administration has been promising is not only was that going to pay for the tax cuts, which, oh, by the way, was never going to work, but also debt becomes more of an issue the slower your economy grows.
Right. That we were going to grow our way out of not only the deficits that the tax cuts created for us, but all of the debt that we have accumulated. Right. Remember, at one point, Trump even promised that he was going to pay down all of our debt. And if, in fact, we have to be more realistic about what our growth trajectory is going to be, it's going to be something more like 2% growth or maybe just a little bit below that, then maybe we need to rethink all of these other ancillary policy problems that we have, including what that means for debt to GDP levels and deficit to GDP levels.
Catherine Rempel at The Washington Post, Kate Davidson at The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, you two, have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, well, let's see. Corporate profits are good. That GDP report was solid. The Fed is almost certainly, definitely, probably, kind of going to cut interest rates next week. Speaking of which, by the way, we want to answer any questions you have about the Fed or interest rates. No question too big or too small. Send them over to us at marketplace.org. As for the rest of Wall Street, equities, bonds, all of that, details, numbers, you know the drill. Here is a supply chain story that's got a quite sizable price tag. Apple is going to spend $1 billion to buy most of Intel's wireless modem business. There are some patents that'll change hands and a couple of thousand employees in that deal as well. But what Apple's really buying here is control, specifically over its own future in the coming world of 5G. And as Marketplace's Jack Stewart reports, a whole bunch of other tech firms want to be their own suppliers as well.
5G is the next generation of mobile technology. It promises super-duper fast connections for phones and homes. But Apple's ability to develop 5G products was held back by a two-year patent battle with supplier Qualcomm over the modem chips that mobile devices need to connect. Eric Gordon at the University of Michigan says Qualcomm had some tough licensing restrictions.
They made some demands of people who licensed their chips that weren't typical. And that really irritated Apple because Apple is used to being the big, powerful person. And here they were getting pushed around.
In April, the sides agreed to a settlement that meant Apple would get vital 5G chips, but would have to get them from its old adversary, Qualcomm.
Apple learned that it never wants to face that kind of battle again.
So Apple's buying Intel's smartphone modem business, which the chipmaker had said it was giving up on. That will give Apple the ability to make the chips it needs in-house. Jack Cutts is from the Consumer Technology Association.
This is something that Steve Jobs was very vocal about when he was still with us, about the vertical integration of Apple.
Apple isn't the only technology firm that wants to control its silicon supply.
Another good example is Amazon Web Services. They're now building their own chip for their data center.
Kevin Crewell is an analyst at Tirios Research. He says Google's building its own chip for machine learning, and Tesla's building the silicon it needs for self-driving cars.
A number of companies are finding that this technology is so critical that they really feel they need to build their own chip.
That way, they're not relying on third-party suppliers, and they're reducing their chance of a legal fight. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
There's a thing happening in the otherwise kind of mundane world of electricity generation. Going carbon-free. No burning of coal, no natural gas, zero net emissions. A big electric utility company in New Jersey, Public Service Enterprise Group, it's called PSEG, says it's going to be clean by 2050, and more than 10 other utilities in the country have pledged the same. There is some manner of pressure here as to who gets there faster. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports on the race to the bottom of fossil fuel electricity.
PSEG in New Jersey says it will be carbon-free in 3 decades. PNM in New Mexico says 2 decades, and Platte River Power in Colorado says 1. Wow. Do we have the technology? Not yet.
They know pretty much how they could get to maybe 80% reduction.
Energy consultant Sue Tierney is with Analysis Group. She says the key is ditching coal and gas and subbing in nuclear, hydroelectric, solar, and wind energy. But on the days that the sun and the wind don't come, you need to somehow bank energy, giant batteries or something.
We really need to have storage at scale so that you could withstand a cloudy period or a drop in wind for many, many, many hours.
That doesn't exist yet, affordably everywhere, nor do the transmission lines or policy rules. But she says utilities are promising no carbon electricity because shareholders and consumers want it. And says Mark Brownstein at Environmental Defense Fund, the stodgy business of the electric company has transformed.
I think some of that is just a culture shift inside the utilities. Old ways of thinking have left the business.
For utilities, leading on climate is good PR. It pushes them. It's seen as the right thing. And it helps them survive. Peter Fox Penner directs the Institute for Sustainable Energy at Boston University.
If utilities don't do this, there are lots of competitive renewable energy suppliers that are young and nimble and would like to take over the role of selling energy and being the trusted brand.
That is, utilities don't want to be dinosaurs, driven extinct by the colliding asteroid known as clean energy. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up. It was a huge, huge high-stakes gamble for Elvis, and he was nervous.
The king takes Las Vegas, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 0.1% today, 51 points, 27,192. The S&P 500 gained 0.7%, 22 points, 3025, 3025. The NASDAQ up 0.1%, 91 points, 83.3. For the week, the Dow added 0.1%. The S&P 500 rose 1.7%. The NASDAQ gained 2.3%. The proposed $26 billion merger between T-Mobile and Sprint moved a giant step closer to becoming a reality today. The Department of Justice has signed off. Still a state lawsuit, but T-Mobile up 5.4% today on the news from the DOJ. Sprint gained 7.3%. Bonds held steady. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note stayed T-Mobile. 10-year Treasury note, 2.07%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We've been in the middle of corporate earnings season these past couple of weeks, which means a lot of companies are doing those long conference calls, talking about how things went last quarter. They can be a bit dull, I'll be honest with you. But if for some reason you did listen in, you'd hear a lot of talk like this.
We continue to see a stronger U.S. dollar relative to last year against
dollar strengthening drove FX headwinds of over one point.
Partially offset by the unfavorable impact of a stronger U.S. dollar.
And a stronger U.S. dollar.
The dollar is hot right now. The president's been tweeting about it, talking about it, too.
We want a strong dollar, but let's be reasonable.
That was in March. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin gets asked about it in those interviews he does on the White House lawn.
Over the long term period of time, again, the long term, I do believe in a strong dollar, which signifies.
That was a couple of days ago on CNBC. And the dollar is being talked about in those corporate earnings calls as well, as I mentioned. So we are going to take a minute right now to explain why people are talking about the dollar and why it matters whether it's strong or not.
In the first quarter of 2018, we had only 18 companies, corporations in North America report negative headwinds due to foreign exchange.
That's Wolfgang Custer. He's the chief evangelist at Kyriba. It's a software company that puts out a report every quarter looking at the effect of currency fluctuations on corporate profits. And yes, chief evangelist is his actual title. We checked.
This quarter alone, you've seen 291 companies reporting negative impacts.
18 companies reported negative headwinds from foreign exchange in the first quarter of last year, 291 companies in the first quarter of this year. Seems like a big deal, right?
Yeah, I think that there's two things to really be highlighted in the last few quarters that look like they're a continuous trend.
Compared with other currencies like the euro and the peso, the dollar is worth more this year than it was this time last year. You can see how that's changed over time at marketplace.org, by the way. But the point is, the dollar is trading higher right now.
A strong dollar, if we're going to talk about U.S. corporates, is really not beneficial to U.S. corporates because at the end of the day, the money they make outside the United States is worth less and their products are more expensive.
A strong dollar means it takes more euros or more pesos or more Chinese yuan for consumers in Europe or Mexico or China to buy American stuff, which is bad for the companies that make American stuff.
But more importantly for corporations is you're actually seeing, while you're seeing a stronger dollar, you're seeing it more volatile. And that typically happens when the fundamentals are pointing one way, but the messaging from the government are the other way.
Fundamentally, the U.S. dollar is strong compared to other currencies because the U.S. economy is strong compared to other economies. But
we have a gentleman that likes a very strong dollar in the Fed.
The president again back in March at the Conservative Political Action Conference.
I want a strong dollar, but I want a dollar that's going to be great for our country. Not a dollar that's so strong that it is prohibitive for us to be dealing with other nations and taking their business.
Key point the president just made there might seem obvious, but currency operates in a global economy too.
He explicitly doesn't mention it, but he wants the Fed to engineer lower interest rates. And in doing so, that helps to weaken the dollar.
That's Kathy Bus-Jancic. She's the chief U.S. financial economist at Oxford Economics.
He's very focused on the trade balance, and he would argue that a weaker dollar would help facilitate exports abroad.
But exporters aren't the only things that matter.
A weaker dollar makes imports from abroad more expensive.
The dollar goes down, and American consumers and manufacturers have to pay more for stuff that's imported.
Now, it's worth noting that the Federal Reserve doesn't target the currency values or the dollar and doesn't really take the dollar directly into consideration when it's setting interest rates.
Here's the point, though.
The U.S. dollar is not a managed currency. It floats freely against other currencies, and it's not managed by our government. It's left up to market forces to determine that value.
The market pushes the dollar up, importers benefit. The market pushes the dollar down, exporters benefit. And then there are the politics of the American economy.
Generally speaking, administrations and the U.S. Treasury will say that they're in favor of a strong dollar because a weaker dollar can tend to be a reflection that our economy is weak, not strong. So while the administration and the president wants a weaker dollar to promote exports, on the other hand, perhaps he should be thankful that the reason the dollar is stronger is because we're seen as one of the stronger economies out there right now.
Which it is. But here's the kicker from the president's chief economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, just this morning on CNBC.
Just in the past week, we had a meeting with the president and the economic principals, and we have ruled out any currency intervention.
So that was this morning. This afternoon, Kudlow's boss weighed in.
Have you ruled out any measures?
On the dollar valuation, why did you not consider a proposal that was floated on Tuesday here?
I could do that in 2 seconds if I want.
Why did you not want to entertain it?
Well, I didn't say I'm not going to do something.
I don't know. The summer of 1969 was pretty busy. You had Apollo 11, Woodstock. Also, Elvis went back into the building in Las Vegas, a set of concerts that launched his comeback and along the way helped change the course of Las Vegas itself. Richard Zoglin has the history of that comeback in his new book. It's called Elvis in Vegas. Richard, good to have you on the program.
Great to be here.
Would you contextualize Las Vegas for me in 1969, just as a reference point?
Yeah, Las Vegas was really having its heyday as a live entertainment center in America, particularly the early 60s, starting with the Rat Pack Show in January 1960, which made Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis, that crowd, the coolest guys in show business. But by the late 60s, things had changed. You know, the culture had changed. The Beatles, the counterculture revolution, yeah. The Vietnam protests, etc. And suddenly, the younger groups, the big rock groups, were not coming to Las Vegas. The younger generation was not coming to Las Vegas. And Vegas was starting to wonder what its future was. So that's when Elvis Presley came on the scene.
How'd it go? He comes out in that, my memory from watching films of this thing is he comes out that first night in a leather sort of suit thing and looks great and wows everybody, kinda, right?
Yeah, he didn't wear the white suit right away. Right. It was black, but... He comes out in this great suit, kind of a two-piece karate-style outfit. This was a big, big deal for him. He had not appeared live. He didn't know for sure whether he could perform the way he used to, but he has a sold-out crowd. This show, by the way, got the biggest publicity campaign Vegas had ever seen. Colonel Parker was good at that. The show was at the International Hotel, the biggest hotel in Las Vegas, with the biggest showroom, twice as large as any other showroom in Vegas. So it was a huge, huge high-stakes gamble for Elvis, and he was nervous.
And it works, right? It works for Elvis, and then it works more to our purposes. It works for Vegas and the industry of Las Vegas.
Right. The show was a huge success. The audience went crazy. But yes, more important for Vegas, it was a huge, important milestone event. It was a new kind of show for Vegas, not so much an intimate nightclub Rat Pack style show, but a big rock concert like extravaganza. And Elvis brought in a different kind of audience. They were not the traditional Vegas crowd, the high rollers, the people who went to see the Rat Pack. A lot of them had never been to Vegas before, but they were a much broader based middle American crowd. I think Elvis's show was kind of a starting gun for all the changes over the next couple of decades that would turn Vegas from a sort of gambling and nightclub town for adults into a big theme park vacation mecca for the whole family.
Draw that line for me from Elvis's 1969 appearances in Vegas and the residencies that are so common now of, you know, Celine Dion was one, you know, a couple of decades, or, you know, I don't
right.
know what, 10, 15 years ago, and now Lady Gaga.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody yeah. who's anybody is doing Vegas residencies.
Yeah. Elvis was the first person to kind of establish a schedule in Las Vegas.
Hmm.
People knew to plan their trips around Elvis. That was not the way in the older days. You'd just come to Vegas and you'd see whoever was there because there were always a lot of great performers right. there. Now it's much more spotty. And so if you want to see Lady Gaga, you plan your trip around when Lady Gaga's coming. Well, I think Elvis was really the beginning of all that.
Hmm. Richard Zoglin, it's a book called Elvis in Vegas. Mr. Zoglin, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Great to be here. Thanks.
We're caught in a trap. I can't walk out because I love you too much, baby.
Come on, Suspicious Minds, you can't beat it. We've got an excerpt and some great pictures from Richard's book, Marketplace.org. This Final note on the way out today. You think the news cycle is moving fast? Try this. In the company's earnings call this morning, McDonald's CEO Steve Easterbrook made much of the fact that drive-through service times are 15 seconds shorter this past June on average than they were a year ago. It's all technology, Easterbrook said, that lets managers, and this is a quote, decompose the various elements of a drive-through visit for a customer into its constituent seconds. How long do we take orders? How long do we take payment? How long it takes to gather the food and present it? How many cars are being asked to pull forward and then bring the food later? Sir, I just wanted a Big Mac. All right, we're out of here. Dow Industrials up a 10% today, 51 points. S&P 500 gained 7/10, 22 points. NASDAQ picked up 1/10%, 91 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you again on Monday, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.